Welcome to The Hours. This is a savvy coaching podcast. I'm Tyler. I'm with my friend Mark. He always says good friend. I don't know if that means I'm a good friend or a good friend. Actually, let me ask you, Mark, am I a good friend or a good friend?
Both.
Wow.
I'm honored. Yeah. Or take it however you want it. How about that?
I'll accept it. I would say you're also a good friend. Okay, here it is. What makes a good friend? And I'm asking the question not as a quality question, like good versus bad friend, as opposed to close friend. Because a lot of times we use the term good friend to just mean close friend.
A quality friend? Yeah, somebody that you would value their opinion on the tough stuff. Like that, I have this decision to make. Who comes to mind? Instead of just someone I like to be around. But I do think also good friends are contagious. Like you want to be around them. You want to spend time with them instead of just somebody I know well.
So a good friend is someone who provides insight, wisdom, and advice in challenging situations.
Yeah, and that you gravitate to, which I also think is good coaches. You want to be around good coaches. Players are drawn to good coaches. Assistants want to be around. Like we want to hang out as a staff. We want to be in the gym. We want to be somebody that, is just contagious to other people.
I would say a good friend is one that gives you what you need in the moment. People will just kind of show up as they feel comfortable. And so if they're an encourager, they only encourage. If they're a truth teller, they only tell the truth. If they're someone that just empathizes, they just kind of provide that ear. Whereas I think a good friend is one that recognizes what role needs to be filled in that moment, and they provide that thing, which I also think is what the feel of a good coach. Many coaches only have one tool, right? It's the anger one, or they only have the rah-rah, right? Or they only have the, well, we got to sit in a stance a little bit more, And whereas I think like a really good coach recognizes what's needed in the moment as well. So good friends make good coaches. And that's what we're about here at Savvy as well, as being a good friend and a good coach, which leads us to our big question. Mark, talk to us about how we can make better in-game adjustments, not to be confused with end-game adjustments, as I often do.
Maybe we'll get crazy and talk about end game adjustments too, but take that for whatever way you want. Are we saying end or end, like Peyton Manning or Peyton Manning? End game adjustments. This is one that comes up a lot this time of year. Common question. Hey, we're playing this team for a second time. What adjustments do we need to make? That would be like out of game, pregame adjustments. But I think end game adjustments have a framework that you work through before you make an adjustment, instead of maybe reacting too quickly or being the coach that doesn't adjust. And like you said, it's like, hey, we just got to play harder. We got to get in a stance. But it's like, well, no, maybe we actually do need to adjust. So first thing, we should have our keys to winning, and we should measure those keys. And before you adjust, I would answer these three questions. Number one, are we playing hard enough? Is the effort there? Number two, are we executing at a high level? Are we doing what we're supposed to do? So we're playing hard enough, we're executing at a high level. Then I would go to question three if the answer is yes to those things. Obviously, if the answer is no to either one of those, then we're not going to adjust. If we're not playing hard enough, that's the adjustment. If we're not executing, then that's the adjustment. Let's execute at a higher level. If those things are yes, I'm going to ask myself the third question: are the right people on the floor? Because the easiest in-game adjustment for you as a coach is to substitute. We can instantly get more rebounds if we put a better rebounder in the game. We can instantly create more space if we put a better shooter in the game. We can instantly impact our ball handling if we put a better ball handler in the game. And, we could go on and on with defensive subs and all that. But I think that would be the three questions I would ask myself before I made any tactical adjustments. Now, let's say the answer is yes to all of those. We're playing hard enough. We're executing what we're supposed to be doing. We have the right people on the floor and it's still not working. Then we have to adjust. Now it may be, all right, we're doing what we're supposed to do defensively and we still can't prevent nines and sevens. Let's go to our secondary defense, or let's extend our defense. Can we be more disruptive? Offensively, we're executing at a really high level, but we're not creating nines and sevens. Then maybe we need to change our action, our primary action that we're getting to. Common one that we would do in driving space is, like, we have options out of Rose series. For those that don't know, Rose series is a series of cuts that we make through the action spots, cuts and screens. And our three primary ones are fingers, fan, and follow, and all of them do the same thing. They create space and advantages, but again, in different ways, and some are more advantageous to run against different styles of defense. So let's say we're running fingers and we just can't crack the shell, we can't create advantage, then maybe we need to lean on fan more. Or we're running these actions, we're not creating advantage, maybe we need to swing the ball more. Maybe the answer is more ball movement with the pass than through the dribble. And those things, I think great coaches can take the nuance of the game, not completely change your identity, your system, but make small tweaks that'll lead to big return on your investment or your change.
I will double down on what you said. The quickest way to make a change of what's happening on the floor is make a change to the personnel. I will add a B to that. If that's A, B is make a change to the roles that personnel are in. So I think there are two ways to change your personnel. You can get a different player from your bench into the game that was not in the game, or you can move around the chess pieces of the players that are in the game into different roles. And I would say that B1 is one that is not used nearly enough and has a massive impact. I think we as coaches overestimate strategic and tactical changes that we attempt to make within a game. We overestimate their impact. And I think we underestimate just moving the chess pieces to different places on the board. Players are going to do what players are going to do. They're going to do what they're good at and shy away from what they're not good at. And that's what I really love about really clear role identification in all of our savvy systems, is it actually gives us more tools as a coach when we can say, okay, I want a little bit more passing from my primary ball handler. I will move them into the racker role. I want a little bit more rim pressure from my primary ball handler. I'm going to move them into the racker role. Okay, we need to actually get out and bolt faster. Okay, well, I'm going to move my fastest player from my racker role to a lock role. And that's going to get us some more bomb passes, right? Or defensively. Okay, I need a little bit more ball pressure right now. And I'm going to put my best on-ball defender. I'm going to move them out of that gap role where they get to rest, and we're going to put them on the ball right now. Or, man, you know, I actually need to protect my best player. I'm going to move them away from the ball so they don't draw fouls. So moving players to different roles is really key. And what I found is coaches value different things in different roles. And that's how the same team can play very, very differently within the same system under two different head coaches. And I get to see this a lot. And the reason I share this, we actually just did some coach development for an athletic department at a college. And we were talking about limiting beliefs. Oftentimes, head coaches have a limiting belief of who's best in what role. And what I would encourage you as a coach to explore is eliminate the limiting belief that this player is best in this role, and instead embrace the understanding that when that player is in that role, your team is best at playing a certain way. That doesn't mean they're necessarily best in that role at all times. And I'll give a very specific example from this weekend. This last weekend, we were playing in a championship game, and I asked the head coach of that team, one of our club teams, I said, who are you going to play as the racker? And they said, player A. And I was like, really? Interesting. I think player B is way more effective as a racker. Why do you want to play, you know, player A? And they said, well, they tend to pass the ball up the floor faster for more bombs. And I was like, you know what? That is true. Player B, who I think is more effective, is a lot faster and puts more pressure on the rim by attacking off of the dribble. And both of those things are true. And knowing what you're trying to adjust will allow you to move the chess pieces way more than saying player A, put more pressure on the rim. They can't do that. Or player B, throw more bombs. They can't do that yet, and it's not going to happen in the game. So asking a player to change their stripes in the midst of a game under pressure is not a good way to make an adjustment. Moving them to a new role is.
I like your B to changing personnel, and this is where my mind went, and it's something I did as head coach. Against full court pressure, we always want to have somebody in the middle. And man, there is something in the water right now in early January. I feel like all the film breakdowns I'm doing for our paid members, it's all either against pressure or half court zone defense. So yeah, something is going around, some zone bug has been caught here, but
poor decision-making and weak ball handlers. That's what's in the water.
There you go. That's in the water. All right. So the question a lot of times is, who do I put in the middle? And the way I did this is a lot of people will look at it as we should put our best playmaker in the middle. I kind of differed on this, although sometimes we would put our best playmaker in the middle because it depends, and that's where I'm going with this. But I would say by default, I would put my worst ball handler in the middle against the press. And here's why. Most presses are designed to take away the middle, and that's the one place where the other coach doesn't want it to go. So they actually handle the ball the least, and when they do get the ball, they're in space, and they don't have it for a long period of time. A lot of times they're clicking it out of the middle. But in my scouting, I would look and say, okay, whether we're in the half court or full court against the zone, do they take away the middle well? What's going to happen a lot? The other four players are going to have the ball. Let's put our weakest ball handler in the middle. If the inverse was true and we think we can get the ball into the middle, well, then I would put a better playmaker there. And I would put my weakest ball handler where I felt like the ball would get to them the least. So that's a way where we can just make those minor changes without even having to go to the bench.
The goal of pressure is to speed up the ball and make poor decisions. Well, our goal when going against pressure is actually to slow down with the ball and make better decisions and attack off the catch and not off the dribble. So one thought for you as you are switching around roles and where you put players is your most dynamic ball handler who's best in the open floor with a numbers advantage, I would say you actually want to have them as the finisher and not the one that's going to initiate your pressure, which is different. So traditionally, like your best ball handler or traditional point guard, let's start the ball in their hands and they're the ones that are receiving the trap. Well, guess what your best ball handler wants to do when they're trapped? They want to dribble because it's what they're best at. We don't want them to dribble against pressure. We want them to pass against pressure. So one of the adjustments that I would encourage you to consider against pressure is don't put your best ball handler as who you're entering the ball into initially. At Savvy, we teach an alignment against pressure, you know, which I call Joker. And Mark has a couple of other words for it, which I don't want to get wrong right now. So in Joker, I would actually move our best ball handler away from the ball, so away from ball side, and I would put them up near half court in our Joker line, up the sideline, knowing that when we receive that first pass, we actually want to cross the street and two out up the street. So then our best ball handler is catching the ball in a little bit of space with a little bit of an advantage, and then they attack the disorganized defense because dribblers are going to want to dribble. So again, that's just another very specific example of moving the chess pieces around to put players in position to utilize their strengths. Mark gave a great example. I gave another example. I don't know if it was great or not. It was just another example to give you a way to do that and figure out what works for your personnel and your team. Hey everybody, this is Tyler, and I'd like to personally invite you to join our free Savvy Coaching community. Post any question you have here in our chat and get your questions answered, as well as get access to all of our free resources in our Savvy community. We've got it all here for you. So click the link below and we'll see you inside.
We'll transition the mailbag here. This one is from our paid community, and I'll just ask it this way. Can you talk about briefly the five reads in conceptual offense?
Beautiful. Yeah, very briefly. Well, a little less briefly, I apologize. So we always have to do context. Why do we break players into five reads? If you just do it and you don't know why, you won't be able to adjust. So always deeply understand the why before you dive into doing something. The intent, the goal is to limit the options that players have on the floor. That's it. Clearly, you want to limit options. When you limit a player's options, they can make quicker decisions. So these are the five reads. So we've got the nine reads, the seven read, the advantage read, the action read, and the ISO read. I'm going to go really, really quickly through these. If you want a player that if no nine, right, they're not wide open by the rim, they don't have a straight line wide open drive for a nine, they're not burn cutting for a nine. If no nine, the moment they catch it, we want them to move it. That would be a nine read. Okay. They could have any one, two, three, or five, or any combination of these. They just need to prove that they can make this read correctly. Like, why would a player not have a nine read? You would take away the nine read if they can't tell the difference between a nine and a five. So if players are continually jacking up bad shots, they can't tell the difference between a nine and a five. They basically don't have the nine read. They're a zero read player. It's like, all I want you to do is pass it, because you can't recognize what is a big advantage wide open layup and what is highly, highly contested. And where we see this happen a lot is on offensive rebounds. And on offensive rebounds, players will not recognize that they don't have a nine and still try to force something bad up. So I would say, I want you to go get offensive rebounds, Mark, but you're a zero read player. You get that offensive rebound, I can't trust you to read nine or five, kick it out. But that's the first read we want people to get. Seven read, obviously, would be able to read, do they have a big advantage off the catch three? That's what we call a seven, a golden seven, 7 out of 10. It's going to be a good shot for us. And they would earn that by their practice earned and game proven performance. We have a lot about shooting ladders. Okay, advantage reads. Most players will catch and dribble neutral. And so if they have the habit of catching and dribbling neutral when they don't have an advantage over the defense, I wouldn't give them the advantage read because they haven't shown the ability to recognize advantage versus neutral. The next read would be an action read. There's some players that you might not want involved in actions because they don't read the action very effectively. And when you put them into action, they actually tend to lose advantage or turn the ball over. If we don't want them being a part of an action, then they should just move the basketball. And then the last read is an ISO read. This is very few players, but there are some players that can create big advantages when they get isolated against their defender in a certain area on the floor. Maybe through mismatches, you know, maybe through a size advantage in the post, whatever. Maybe they're just so good, like Kevin Durant, they're a walking mismatch wherever they touch the ball. So those are the five reads that a player can have the freedom to make. And every player probably is going to have some combination of those reads. Mark, right now you're playing in a men's league game. What reads do you have the freedom? Would you give yourself the freedom to make?
Considering walking mismatch was my nickname in middle school, I would go level five. No. Men's league, I'm going, depending on the level of the men's league, I'm like 3-4. I think all things being equal, I'd like to hunt action. I think that's my game.
Beautiful. Men's league game right now, I'm actually just going, I can make the nine read, I can make the seven read, I can make the advantage read. I think there's better people at actions than me right now. So I'm not gonna give myself the action.
Your men's league game must be way higher level than mine.
There you go.
All right. Let's ask, can I ask you a lock left question?
Yeah.
I would say lock left is probably the most asked about system, savvy system in our mailbag.
Why is that?
I think it's because it's different.
Yeah.
And newer. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but like what percentage of teams do you think run lock left?
Of all teams in the entire basketball world? Oh, this is a good question. And I'm probably skewed towards a higher number because it's what I see the most. It's people send me films. I'm probably skewed towards a higher number and 3%.
I was going to say 3% being a little high too, though. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of teams out there at a lot of different levels. Yeah. Here's the lock left question. And it's one that comes up a couple times a year. Oh no, we're facing a team that their best player, their best two players are left-handed. Should we adjust? Or if we don't adjust, what do we do?
There are two sides of the coin of every question. Every time you choose to do something, you're giving up something else. That's how it works. When you choose to lock left, you're giving up something else. Now, through practice, development, training, we are choosing to strengthen our side of the coin, what we're choosing to attack or what we're choosing to take away. And so the number one most important thing that I answer is, you spent all this time getting good at something. Don't do something that you haven't spent time getting good at. Continue to lock left. Now, there are pros and cons to locking left a left-hander. A con of locking left a left-hander. They're going to be stronger and make better decisions when you make the ball go left and it's in their left hand. They're going to make better decisions than a right-hander would. That's a con of doing that. But there are pros of doing that as well. Besides that, we've strengthened that side of the coin. We know how to overload the floor there. We know where our help's coming from. We're good at this. They're not good at this. The pro is the goal of lock left is we want the ball to go left. A lot of righties are reluctant to go left. Lefties are not reluctant to go left. They'll go left right away. They will throw out their offense or their action or their spacing because we're making them do what they actually internally want to do so badly. And that is a pro. So there are pros and cons. You continue to do it. And the strength of lock left isn't actually that players are weaker dribbling with their left hand. That's not the strength of lock left. The strength of lock left is that we limit space, put more defenders where the ball is, and we force players to do what they're worst at, which isn't just dribbling with their left hand. It's making decisions quickly while on the move. And that's really the strength of Block Left.
Also, we know where they're going, right? They're playing from our spots. So if they're more inclined to go left, we all know a lefty that we're encouraging to go left will take that invitation. So now we can all load up and single task defensively.
That's right. We're running great. We're averaging a lot of points. We're attacking advantages. The one thing we're struggling with is finding a better rhythm and pace to our drive and space offense when we're neutral. We're playing very fast through the triggers and actions. Any ideas for this? Emphasizing bounce outs has helped.
Interesting that this coach said that they're actually playing fast through their triggers and actions. So maybe they're just not getting there fast enough is maybe what I'm hearing there. I think this is the value in being a paid member is I would really answer this question with send me the film. And let me see what the root cause is. So I'll do my best guess here. I've watched enough film. I've worked with enough coaches where I can maybe give a guess of what the issue is. It sounds like they're not moving the ball against a sagging defense, if I had to guess, because he says he's playing fast through their action. So I think when they get to action, they're good. But I'm envisioning a defense sagging off and them just catching and holding and like, okay, well, what do we do? The defense is sagging. I would say this, and this kind of goes back to in-game adjustments, evaluate of like, what are they, like you said, defenses give something up and take something away. What are they taking away? They're taking away driving lanes. So let's move the ball with the pass. And I would encourage more of a 0.5, like let's click it around the perimeter and see if we can get them extended out of their shell. Maybe they're a pack line team. Generate some ball speed to where now we get them to creep out of their shell. Now when we get to one of their actions, we've created more space, because I think spacing and ball movement, regardless of the defense, is going to break you down. It is the enemy of all defense. If I told you, man, we're facing a team that has really great spacing and really great ball movement, automatically you're like, oof, this is going to be tough. It doesn't even matter what they run. So that's the lens that I'm looking at it through. But I'm looking at this question in the mailbag right now. The good thing is this member is a paid member. So shoot us the film and I'll tell you exactly what I would do to fix this.
If you're listening, I challenge you. I'm just going to challenge you. I challenge you to give us a try for 1 month in our exclusive paid membership. Everyone that joins, they send Marker iFilm. We send them back 8 to 10 minute Loom, breaking down, identifying and suggesting fixes and enhancements. And they respond, wow. I mean, I don't think I've ever had someone not respond, wow, that was so helpful. I really do. Of all the things that you get with our exclusive membership, from every course in our classroom, Block Left, Drive Space, Race Space, Drill Book, whatever, from the community interaction and encouragement from other coaches and chopping up ideas and getting support, right? From the responses and training that Mark and I give in the community posts, all of that, that is not the most valuable. The most valuable is you get us to do video feedback for you when you're a paid member. So come try it. If it's not worth it, then like I said, you have 30 days, we'll give you your money back because we just really believe it is. It's so helpful for us. Like when someone verbally asks me a question about coaching, okay, I can give you an answer that maybe gives you 20-30%. But if we can actually look at film, film don't lie, like Larry the Legend Bird said, film don't lie. And we can absolutely give things that can like double you up right away. So I invite you to do that. You can head over to savvycoach.com and you can find it. We'll have the link down below wherever you're watching or listening to this. Come give us a try. If you don't believe me, try me. And Mark, what's our next question?
Our next question is trigger through the corner. I know this is one that, I don't know, maybe we're aligned on this one.
No, we're going to disagree. Yeah. I'm committed to disagreeing with you here.
I hope we do. All right. What is your favorite action when the ball ends up in the corner? This coach is running 5-out drive in space.
Okay. Mine's really simple. Don't. That's the only reason to pass to the corner is because there's an advantage there. And if we're neutral, there's no advantage there. Get the ball out of there and run your action from somewhere else. Every defense, nearly every defense that I know of, likes the ball in the corner. Very few offenses like the ball in the corner. And so why would we want to trigger our action from there? You have limited space. You have the most limited passing angles, I think, of anywhere on the floor. So I'd say just don't trigger actions out of it.
All right. I don't necessarily disagree, but I'm going to give a different perspective here because there's nuance to all of this, right? Like, is the ball going to go
black and white, Mark? Okay.
That's right. It's binary, right? Now, here's a teaching. Defense, let's make it as binary as possible, right? Lock the ball left. If you're on the gap side, skirmish. If, you know, if you're on the free side, snipe. Just one job, zero excuses. On offense, it's not always that easy, right? That's where all the decisions and reads come into play. So are we going to pass the ball to the corner thinking they have an advantage, or are we going to be in trouble and we have to throw the ball to the corner because if not, something worse is going to happen? Yes, the ball is going to hit the corner. My favorite action out of the corner is to get the ball out of the corner as quickly as possible because defenses like it there. So here's how I would do that. We want to shoot it, drive it, or move it on every catch. Let's pretend that we didn't shoot it and we didn't drive it, meaning attack a closeout. Then let's move it out of the corner two ways. Obviously, one with the pass. And a principle that we play with through driving space, especially when the ball is in the corner, pass to the first open player. And that actually might be a good answer to our previous mailbag question of like, hey, I feel like we're getting bogged down and slow. Maybe a better answer when I was talking about a sagging defense, like take what they're giving you, man. Like they're giving you ball movement, pass to the first open player, generate ball speed, and let's create some rhythm and pace back in our offense. So how do we do that from the corner? One, we say this at Savvy all the time, teach players where to look. So when I get the ball to the corner, my eyes should immediately be going up to the action spot because that is when we're neutral, we want to run action. Most of our action comes through the action spot. That's called Rose series. So I catch, if I don't shoot or drive, I'm looking up to the action spot. If they're open, I'm moving it immediately. If they're not open, here's my favorite action, is an uphill DHO. Most DHOs, I think, are overrated because we're dribbling downhill to give it to somebody going uphill away from the basket. Easily switchable, easily trappable. Just my opinion. If you differ, join our community and tell me so. Uphill DHO is a pseudo ball screen, pseudo handoff. It's right in the middle. It's gray area, which we like because that creates uncertainty for the defense. And now we're giving it to a player that is going downhill. So if the ball doesn't go down up over in the Rose series, I love an uphill DHO, which we call a bust, which is in our Drive in Space course, which is only available for paid members, which is another reason why you should pay and all that good stuff about us giving your money back if you don't like it. Game of the week. Game of the week. Game of the week.
So we kind of go game of the week and drill of the week interchangeably. And what I'm going to share this week is going to be anything can be a game if you gamify it. We're going to talk about tune shooting. So in our shooting method, we have three steps that I believe will really help a player improve faster. Traditionally, it would be just go shoot, right? And not all shooting drills, techniques, games should give you the same outcomes. So I like to distinguish with a shooter when we're developing, what's our intent? And intent leads to intensity or a greater return on the time invested. So tune, our intent is not to make shots. And that's probably the biggest switch that players need to flip if they want to improve their shot, is they need to actually put their intent into something other than the outcome of the shot going in. So tune up is to get something else developed other than make more shots. This is key. And I'm going to spend most of our time on this before I define the other two, because most players, most of the time when they do a shooting workout, are trying to make shots. Okay, I'm shooting 500, I made this many, or I'm going until I get 100 makes, or I'm going to see how many I make out of 10 with this sort of dribble move or whatnot. And when you focus on makes, you're actually going to inherently do the thing that you're most comfortable with, which is the enemy of improvement. So tune is what we're going to tune up our technique. Train is also not focused on making shots. We might take a sample of what our makes are when we do this training, but the training is not to try to make shots. It's to try to develop a footwork or a way to get more shots. It's a way to try to get more speed on your shot. It's a way to try to get comfortable shooting out of an action, right? That's training. Then testing is when we actually are trying to make shots. Everything else goes out the window. Singular focus. Let's perform on the test. Let's score really, really well. So that's the framework. Most players need to spend the majority of their time on tuning and training and the minority of their time on testing. And so that would be the biggest switch coaches would make. So we are going for game of the week, one way to tune a shot. So I would tune your shot this way. And we're going to use lunge shooting as our game of the week. And lunge shooting is just to tune a feeling of loading the hips deeply. So one of our favorite tune-ups in our game of the week is lunge shooting. And you'll do this in sets of five. You'll get five lunges on the right leg, five lunges on the left leg. You start with a deep forward lunge. You'll push yourself back into your shooting footprint and then rise up into your shot. What this will do is it's going to actually engage your core and force your hips to get lower than is comfortable. This also allows you to develop reps getting on balance before you go up into your shot, not to mention just the benefits of strengthening one's legs. The goal of tuning up your shot is we want to see if we can get to a simple, repeatable, effective shot out of many dynamic and different situations. How can we get ourselves on balance? How can we get ourselves to a repeatable start position so that we can do the same thing over and over? So that's lunge shooting. That's one way to challenge players. And it's a tune-up that I'd use at the beginning of your pre-practice. All right, Mark, you want to take us into our teach better?
Yeah, we're going to go teach better, and teach better is going to be a stride stop. And I want to start this by just sharing some film of when do we stride stop, because I think that is the most important skill of all. We could get your team to stride stop within 5 minutes, I think. But getting them to know when to stride stop is where the real value is. And a stride stop is used, and I have some flow in here if you're watching on YouTube, game film of us stride stopping. You stride stop when two things occur. One, when you're stopping with speed. If we are at speed, a jump stop becomes very unnatural. It's usually where our momentum takes us forward, and it looks like a travel even if we don't. The second reason why we stride stop is when we're unsure. Going back to our reads, if I'm a one read player and I can only read a nine, if I don't have a nine, I have to have the ability to stride stop, which is going to allow me to create vision and space for myself where I can now pass out to a teammate, hopefully with a bigger advantage, which you see all here. I'm going to go through this one slower here. We're dribbling. We stride stop with speed. And what I love about this example here is we pivot, it increases our vision, and we find our teammate for a nine. In all of these examples, or most of these examples, we're also creating longer closeouts on the floor. So in this case, we stride stop, our eyes are coming to the weak side of the floor. What I often find is teams will kick to this player, again, going back to the mailbag, in the corner, they're neutral, they have no advantage. So now offense just has to reset. And when offense resets, defense gets to reset too. So I love the fact that our eyes are going to the weak side of the floor, and that's usually where the help comes from. So that's going to be where the advantage is or create the longer closeout. I've got film here of us playing against Duke. This was actually one of our best footwork games. We got to a ton of protection plans, a lot of stride stops, because the best teams on your schedule, and Duke was obviously one of them, can guard the ball one-on-one. So we had a lot of these small advantage that would have been a five-ish so-so shot that we were able to turn into bigger advantages because we were equipped. We were able to stride stop, pivot, see the floor, and throw to the weak side for advantage. All right, now the good stuff. How do we teach a stride stop? I'm going to take us through this fairly quickly because, like I said, I think teaching the stride stop is actually fairly easy. It's knowing when to do so. So we have a player here, and she's going to demonstrate. She was actually in a lot of the game film here. She's going to demonstrate exactly how I teach a stride stop. I would just get a player walking. This seems very simple. But what I wanted her to feel is a stride stop is just walking or running into your stride. And that's why we call it a stride stop. So we would just start just like that. I want to just introduce what a stride stop is because this is very new to players. I have found most players have only been taught a jump stop. The next progression is for them to dribble and stop on one leg. Can we get balance? Can we stop our momentum? If you have a vision of what if you're not watching on YouTube, of what a pitcher looks like in baseball, when they lift that leg before they throw to home, that's where we would stop. The next piece is coordinating our hand and foot. So I'm going to go through this one slow. A right hand dribble is going to trigger a right foot stop. And I want the right foot to land at the same time we pick up the ball. So this is pretty close here. I have found this is the most undertaught part of the stride stop. And this is where they can get more like hopping into their stop, or they're called for travels because we don't coordinate hands and feet. Another side note is we use a stride finish, which is just a stride stop into a finish. This would be our left foot falling, and then now we jump. So a lot of finishing I have found is less about these like finishing moves. It's more about coordinating your hands and your feet. Same with the stride stop. All right. So the last piece is going to be allowing this left foot to fall, and gravity is just going to take you there, because when we stop with speed, we're going to slam on the brakes with our right foot and our left foot's going to naturally fall. That is the stride stop. So the last thing we would do is just now put it all together, do it at speed, and then add pivots so we can now practice where do our eyes go, how do we create space, how do we pivot out of pressure when unsure.
I mean, I feel like I just got better, Mark.
I love the stride stop. And as I know you do too, it's such a weapon when you can use it effectively on offense.
How much time in practice per day should a coach dedicate to stride stops if they wanted to make it a core skill for their team?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. It actually came up in a consulting call this morning with a college coach. And we're trying to eliminate turnovers in his program because they are right on the cusp of being really, really good. And he's like, we just have to eliminate like 5 turnovers a game. So where do those turnovers come from? Well, you know, we travel a lot, or we don't play out of pressure very well. And he's like, man, I feel like we need to go like old school, just like line up and like practice stride stops and pivots. So I'm like, well, maybe. But he has embraced the savvy method of like, hey, we compete, we're games based, we're constraints led. But I said, well, man, that's our warm up. Like that, we're priming them physically and mentally of we're going to have to do this a lot. Now, it's not telling them when they do it, but let's just build that foundation. So I'd say it needs to exist in your practice in one way or another. And it could just maybe this is the next game of the week, but either or, like, let's play 1-on-1. You either get a 9. Or you have to stride stop, or play small advantage games, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, where you're just starting with the opportunity to create advantage, or unsure, stopping with speed. That's going to be a stride stop and play. I would say our players in a 2-hour practice probably stride stopped 50 times. I mean, that's just a random guess, but not in drills, just more so in games. Just when you play this system, it just shows up so much.
Okay, sneak preview of next week, and we'll make sure to capture it. We'll go into the Teach Better segment next week, how to encode success, how to encode success, and we'll continue to play on the stride stop piece there. If you want your players to be successful with a stride stop in these games that Mark is talking about, I'm going to share how to encode success through establishing your pre-practice. And I think we'll get really granular and clear on how you can go and implement stride stops or any skill that you would like to see your team get better at. That's a little teaser for the hours next week. As always, thank you for spending hours with us. It's really fun every week as we get to see viewership, downloads, everything increase. So we know that we're helping coaches, which is what we're about at Savvy, is we are on a mission to revolutionize the way the game is taught by all of us as coaches and played by all of the players every year that we get to impact, because then they're going to go and they're going to coach the way that they were coached by us. There are ripple effects to what you are doing as a coach. And so I just thank you for investing your time with us so that you can do better. There are coaches out there that are not investing any time to get better, and you're not one of those coaches. So thank you for being a savvy coach. And savvy just means you want deep understanding of your craft.
If you've made it to the end of the episode, you probably found value in this. So share it with a coach, hit the like button, give us a 5-star review. We would appreciate it so we can continue to share and increase our impact on basketball.
All right. Thanks all. Until next time, stay savvy.
Stay savvy.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner. So you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you. And most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.